Skype and this video communication tool, as I said, they are really based on the telephone model. I call you, we talk, and then we're done, and we hang up. Now, is this really how people communicate? Well, it's true that a lot of our communication is direct, focused communication, where I need to talk to you, and once we've established communication, it lasts a certain time, and when we're done, it's finished. And email, telephone, to some extent, instant messaging support this type of communication. But the other thing that people like to do is to stay in touch. So this is what we call peripheral awareness. How am I aware that there are other people in the room? Well, if they are in the room, it's fairly easy. You can have two people working at two ends of the room, and they are aware of maybe what the other is doing, if the other is very busy and concentrated, or if the other person can be interrupted or disturbed. But current technologies do not really support this peripheral awareness. Before you call someone, you don't know if the person is busy or not. You don't have a signal from that person that tells you if he or she is interruptible. So one thing we discovered in this project I'm going to talk about is staying in touch is something very important for people who are close friends or people who are significant others or with your family, etc. It's also sometimes important when you work together in a distributed setting. For example, in agile programming, there's this notion of peer programming, where people sit together at a computer to work together. Now, for peer programming to work, people have to literally be sitting next to each other. If they are at a distance, it's very difficult. If you have a system that makes them feel like they are together, then you can do peer programming at a distance. The other thing we found is that people, when they, people have become very, some people have become very suspicious of what happens on the internet and what happens to the messages they exchange on the internet. And then the other category of people who are completely unaware of the risks of putting stuff on their Facebook page and other things. However, everybody has a notion of things they would not put in an email or wouldn't, send in a letter or they wouldn't say on Skype, because they have this vague notion that someone could either eavesdrop, that is, listen on the conversation, or capture the conversation, or use it against them one way or the other. But what we found is you have this tension, because people on the one hand are suspicious of these technologies, and at the same time they want to share private messages with typically small groups of people, their significant other, their close relative, friends, and sometimes co-workers. And of course, social networks do not address this need. You're not going to use Facebook for this. They want you to think that you can, but many stories of people who thought they sent something private and ended up publicly available. So, in 2001, we ran a project that was called Interliving. It was a European project in what was called the Disappearing Computer Initiative. So, I don't know if you know, but the European Union puts a lot of money into research. So, since it's money that comes from the state, it's your money, it's my money, it's our taxes. And there are several billion euros every year put into research. And a large amount of it is put in the what's called the Framework Program. We are currently, I think, in the 7th Framework Program, and they usually last for 4 or 5 years. And within this program, there is a subset for IST, information something technology. And under the information technology section, there is something called FET for emerging technologies. So the Disappearing Computer Initiative was, there's a few hundred million euros for, probably around 100 million euros for and to realize Mark Weiser's vision of the computer disappearing in our environment or becoming part of the environment such that we don't really notice that it is there or not there. In the same way we have tables in classrooms, we don't pay attention when they are there. The computer should become part of our life. So we had the project called Interliving that was accepted under this program. And that was a project with partners in Sweden. And there was also a small group in the US. And in case you wonder why the European Union would fund a project with American partners, in fact, the US partners did not get money from the European Union. They were funded from their side, but they were participating in the project. So we wanted to study communication within distributed families. A lot of families are distributed, and I think a number of you here, family, in other countries, in other parts of the world, even within France. My brother lives in Paris, but my mother is in Bordeaux, and my father lives in French Guiana, so we don't often see each other. And so we wanted to study how existing technologies help these people, these distributed families, to better communicate and stay in touch, and whether we could develop more better technology for them. And so we used the participatory and the multidisciplinary approach. We involved real families, so we put ads in newspapers to recruit participants. That was in itself an interesting thing in terms of the type of responses we got. But we recruited several families in France and US and Sweden, and overall there were more than 70 family members involved in this project. And we did a lot of observation, we did a lot of workshops with families, I'll show a quick video. We developed a number of technology prototypes that we put in these families' homes, and we studied how they used them. Now, so the techniques we're using here are the type of things you're doing in Wendy's class. I'm assuming most of you are there. Now, doing this with families when you talk about their everyday life is a little bit more complicated because it's one thing to say, you know, do interviews or do observations of people at work, because once you know, their boss says it's okay to do it and the people agree to do it, it's fine. When you go observe people in their homes, it's a little more tricky. So we were quite careful to not sort of intrude in their private lives, but we wanted to see how people communicate and how they work together. So we used a number of techniques here, and one is called the cultural probes from Bill Gaylor, where we give family members a number of ways to capture aspects of their everyday life. So we gave them a small camera so they could take pictures of things they find, you know, relevant or important. We gave them a notebook where they could write things. We, in some cases, we put the notebook next to the door and we asked them to write things every time they would go in and out and things like this. So it's ways to capture information without you, the researcher, being in there. And of course, we know it is biased, and you know, people may not play the game or people may not tell you exactly what's happening, but that's a way to capture information. And we also conducted workshops, and so we had those families come together, and even in one case we flew all the French family to Sweden, and then we also flew the Swedish families to France. Interesting to have people who don't speak the same language work together. And we had them prototype various technologies with the same techniques again as you're using in Wendy's class. So one thing that came up is that it's one thing to go and observe how people communicate with those different techniques, even if you do it directly yourself through interviews or things like this, or through these cultural probes, which are things you give people and ask them to collect information for you. But the next step at this point, we were not, you know, we were not confident that we could solve their problem. So what we wanted to do was to give them a piece of technology that in our mind was unfinished and see how they would appropriate it. So we give them something, we don't exactly know what it is, and we want to see how they use it or not use it. So we created this concept that we call technology pros, this is a concept that's been taken on by a number of other researchers. In fact, of all the papers that I have published, there's a zillion co-authors, so it says Hutchinson et al., but it's the papers that have been the most highly cited of my papers. So it's a concept that people have found interesting. And so we designed this simple prototypes that were doing a single thing. I will describe a couple of them. They were designed to not solve a problem, but better to understand a need by challenging the users, the families, into, okay, what can you do with that? Is that interesting? So there were three goals with the technology pros. One was to a source of inspiration for both us as designers, but also for the users. Because what we observe is that if you do a focus group, if you go visit people and you ask them, oh, how would you like to communicate? I mean, they're going to come up with a magnified phone or email or chat system. You know, it's very hard for people to imagine other things. So by putting into their hands something different from anything they've seen before, even if it doesn't, if they don't like it or it doesn't solve their problem, it will make them think out of the box. And for us, observing that is also a way to capture information about you know, how they react to different pieces of technology. So the goal was to also test a specific technology in people's homes. And what we found at the time that, you know, people did not always have high-speed internet access. They didn't have things that were necessarily reliable. So building technology that you go into someone's home, put it there, and hope it's going to run for a week or a month is very challenging. And we learned a lot on that, on how to make things more more reliable, also how to be able to maintain them from a distance and things like this. And finally, these devices were collecting data. So it was also a source of data for us. And we could compare the data collected through these devices with what the other, with what the users were telling us on how they use it and how they go about their lives in general. So I think I'm going to show a video. It's doing weird things, of course. So this is a video presenting the project, and probably will recognize the voice.
Interliving is a 3-year participatory design project with the goal of designing interactive, intergenerational interfaces for families that live together.
It's bigger now.
We're working closely with 7 families. 3 in Sweden, 3 in France, and 1 in the United States. The families each include a core family with parents and children, and related households with grandparents, grown children, or siblings with their own families. We use a wide variety of methods, including interviewing family members in their homes, and asking them to participate in various activities, such as drawing maps of their relationships with each other, or taking pictures of favorite objects within their homes. The most important design activity involves workshops, in which we invite the family members to join us for a day of reflection and design. We begin by listening to stories from the different family members and giving them the opportunity to share information they have created, such as photographs, relationship maps, and journals. The next step is to develop these stories into scenarios that retain context and detail and are grounded in real-world experiences. Next, everyone gets to participate in generating ideas for new technologies, no matter how crazy or off the wall. We use standard brainstorming and word games, but also ask the family members to build mock-ups and explore their ideas with video cameras. final stage is to bring the use scenarios and the technology ideas together in the form of videotape design scenarios, what we call video prototypes. Everyone participates, including children and grandparents. Some ideas are practical, such as helping mothers keep track of other members of the family. Others are more whimsical, involving lightweight ways of staying in touch with a particular loved one. We are now developing more complex prototypes based on our design work with the families and the information we have gathered from them, which will provide more effective and fun ways for distributed families to stay in touch.
So that's the video we did at the end of the first year of the project, where we're in this exploratory phase of understanding people's needs and also imagining completely off-the-wall ideas with them. My favorite in there is this girl here. So she was a 6-year-old or 7-year-old at the time, and she came up with this idea of an umbrella. And she has a best friend, and they would each have an umbrella, and when they want to speak to each other, they open the umbrella, and the thing would just put them in touch. So this is the kind of thing you were looking for, you know, not try to give us the next cell phone and the next thing. There was also a couple of adults that were, so she was working on the floor in the not a supermarket, but a clothing place. And she's not allowed to take phone calls or to send SMS or to do any of this while she's working. And she still wanted to stay in touch with her boyfriend. And so she had this idea that, you know, she had a watch that could do a little puff of air to give her like a sense of touch when he was thinking of her. So we had a lot of ideas of how people can stay in touch with very simple signals. It didn't have to be, you know, full-blown video conferencing or whatever, but staying in touch means exchanging very potentially small messages that people have agreed upon can overload with meaning that other people wouldn't have. And just these little things would help people feel that they're more in touch. One of the Swedish families had a complicated life because they were working far away. They had to leave home before the kids woke up for school. The kids were, probably 12 or something. And so every day, halfway through their way to work, they would stop the car and call home to make sure that the kids are up and everything is fine, etc., etc. So the thing is, when you go into the details, and I think this is really, I've said that before, I'll say it again, it's really important to go into the details of practical things of people's lives, and that's where you can understand some needs that then generalize to other people. If you stay on the surface, you're not going to come with anything very innovative. So, the first technology probe we developed was called Video Probe. And the idea was to have a device designed for sharing images of everyday life. We should probably have called it Photo Probe, actually, because there's no video per se in there. Now, one thing we discovered very quickly is we built the first prototype, and it was, you know, a PC with a bunch of cables, a mouse, and a keyboard, and it looked like a PC. And we figured if we are going to go into people's house and put this there, they will, you know, they will either see it as a computer, or they would think it's horrible and they want to use it. So we actually worked with industrial designers to help us package those probes into something that did not look too much like a computer. So they came up with this device here that has an LCD screen, a video camera, video camera. The computer is hidden in there. There is a small remote control. And what the system does is the camera is always on. So the system is always capturing video. It's not storing. It's just, and it takes pictures automatically. So it's not something where you have to push a button to take a picture. In fact, you cannot touch a button to take a picture. So how and when does it take a picture? Well, it takes a picture when it thinks there is something interesting. And the notion of something interesting is that something different from the background image comes in front of the camera, and this thing stops moving for 3 seconds. So the idea is that if the device is here and I walk by, nothing happens. If there's nobody in front, nothing happens. But if I walk in front, I stay in front, I will see a square drawing on the screen telling me something's about to happen, and at the end of the 3 seconds that it takes to grow, it takes a picture, and I hear a snap. And this picture is sent to the other device that this one is coupled with. So they work in pairs. We could have made it more than two, but we built only two in the beginning. They work in pairs, and so every image is taken on one side or shown on the other side, and vice versa. Now, these images are not meant to be kept, so they actually disappear automatically. They fade out. So after a while, images go away. And if you want to look at the images, you use the little remote control, and you can flip through the images. Now, there's one thing that people asked that we added, was the ability to keep an image. Because you don't want to keep all the images because you have hundreds of images and most of them are, you know, no interest. Actually, they are interesting to watch once, but then once you've seen it, it goes away. But they wanted to keep some images for the future. So we added a function. And so we took the simplest remote control we could find, and we removed still half of the buttons, so we only had next, previews, and keep. And then we went and installed this in people's homes. It was interesting in itself to see where people wanted to place this device. So she was living in a very small apartment, she decided to have it right in front of her kitchen table, which was also her desk. So she knew that she was going to spend most of her time in front of this thing. This other user put it into his entry hall, where, you know, it was only going by once in a while. So people, you know, were already deciding to how they would interact with this. So the thing we found is that, and this is what we were hoping would happen, is this co-adaptation phenomenon. People discover a new piece of technology, something they've never seen before, used before, and they figure out ways to use it that we didn't anticipate. So what we found is people were using it to exchange messages, and explicitly we did not want to support the notion of exchanging messages, but we saw a number of situations where people would put objects in front of the camera, write something on the note, and put it from the camera to send a message to the other side. We saw people who were playing with adjusting the placement of the probe so that it would take pictures when they were doing certain activities. Now, as I said, we're using motion detection on the video stream. So if you are here, you know, far away enough, feeding your kid, it's likely that the system will take a whole series of images because it finds something that is different from just the background because there is this shape in front, but it's not moving enough that it stops the thing that takes the picture. If you had put it closer to the table, the motion would be too much to have it take pictures. We had people used it in ways to sort of exchange photos of themselves, and etc. Now the thing is, what was important about the system is this notion that it's mostly autonomous, that you don't have to do anything. And after, the idea was that after a while, you know, when you put the thing in your home the first time, you would play with it, right? But after a while, people will forget about it. And we were interested in seeing what happens after this initial period where it becomes part of people's life. Do they just ignore it? Do they turn it off? Do they, does it make sure that they never look at? Or what happens? So the only explicit action you had really was to browse the pictures and store the ones you wanted to keep. So what we found is families really love video program. It gives them an implicit sharing of everyday life. And that worked well when people were close by. But there are various ways of being very close to other members of your family. So there was one case where it was two cousins who were very good friends, but you know were living on each side of Paris and didn't get to see each other very much. There was also these Italian families, and there were two brothers, each married and with children, so two households with four people. But they were very close, they were living in the same street, they were seeing each other all the time. But they still loved the idea that they come home and they can browse the picture and they get this day at a glance of what happened at the other side. And interestingly, it increased the use of the phone rather than decrease it. And the reason was, by browsing those photos, people could get an idea of whether you know, the other people are at home, whether they're busy or it's okay to call them. You could also see events that you could talk about on the phone. So one point, you know, the mother of one of the parents came by their home, and it's the other families who saw it first. And so they called, say, oh, your mother came today. And so it sort of really made the people closer. And it became part of this everyday routine where you know people would stop in front of the device before leaving, saying hi and going. So it really became part of their life. Now, the thing is, it was really hard to deploy. It didn't. The motion detection was pretty tricky to calibrate, so it would take either too many pictures or too few pictures, and we didn't have a good way to adjust that. At the time, the networks were flaky, and so things would break, etc. So I have a video here, or a series of videos, of this. So this was the first version that the designers built and showed us how it works. So we see the device, and here you see a picture is being taken. Now there was this stupid thing that people expect to see this as if they were in a mirror, so we reverse the image when it's being captured, but not when we're sending it, because people are sensitive to things being mirrored, so it's one of these things. So this is the interface to browse the images. We made them look like photos thrown on the table. And you can simply...
You can go through the images in front to see that.
So then we tested this at home. So this is our other son playing Lego. And this is what I was saying about adjusting the sensitivity, whether it takes too much picture, not enough. But even if it takes a lot of pictures, the browser could go through them pretty quickly. So it was, you know, still interesting. This was the installation that the Violet family, we gave each family a color, so we didn't have to identify them by hand. So at first she installed, so in one apartment it was in this entry hall, and that's the other one we saw in the kitchen. And she really wanted to have it very low so the camera would be at her height when she was sitting. And so this is, you know, a day in the life of, and this is what the system captures when she's there in the morning and calling and getting ready to go out. And her cousin, which is the one that was linked to this device, you know, would browse those images and could tell whether to call her or not. You can see where there are people. Now, the tricky thing is that this is the bathroom there, so... Now, needless to say, we got authorization to show these images, to show it for teaching and for research, so... So, now this is the yellow family. They had two kids, and they were playing a lot with sending messages.
Et les jeunes, ils faisaient quelque chose.
Non.
Tu ne sais pas.
Non,
non, parce que
c'est ils ont pris en photo, ils font des grimaces, ils font des choses comme ça, mais
so we had a problem there that the system is facing this window, and just changing the lighting, like clouds coming by, would trigger photos. So there was a lot of figures of photos of this window. But they really wanted to have it in their living
room. Et à un moment, Cagnot a reçu plein d'images. Moi, je ne savais toujours pas. Et ça a commencé le vendredi à bien fonctionner. Mm-hmm. Parce que là, bah maintenant, il y a tout.
Ah, oh, Pavlo Stéphane, il doit faire tout le temps.
Ce qu'on a vu tout à l'heure, on les a avec un grand décalage quand même. Ça, c'est déjà.
De toute façon, les avoir
voilà. Regardés. Non, 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 j'en ai regardé.
Now, one thing that happened is that there was. This was installed before Christmas, and they had the Christmas dinner, and they changed the position of the device so it would take pictures of the dinner so they could share it with their other family. Okay, so I'll put the full video if you want to watch it. And so that's the day of life for the yellow family. The thing you have to realize is this is a lot less intrusive than if you had a constant video feed. There is no audio. So it's really this idea that you don't need to have high bandwidth communication to have rich communication. You know, I mean, we don't know these people, so, you know, we don't recognize them. But for people who know each other well, they can get a lot of information just on these snapshots. And the fact that at the time it was poor video quality and all that was probably a good thing as well, because you don't want too much detail either. So if I were to redo this today, I would probably make it less good quality than the images we have today. Okay. Now after that, we move to a second system that we call Mirror Space. And with Mirror Space, we really wanted to experiment with video, not just still images. And the thing is, we knew from experience that video is very intrusive. And so we wanted to make it so people could have video communication without the explicit thing of making a call and these kind of things. but also without feeling like there was a camera in their home. For those of you who are French, we did this project when Love Story came out the first time in France. And for those of you who are not French, Love Story was the first reality show that was shown in France, where people, you know, were living in this fake house with cameras everywhere. And so people were quite sensitive to the idea of having a camera in your home and not knowing exactly what was happening to the images. So we are very careful about making it, again, not look like this is a reality show kind of thing. So what we came up with was this device that looked like a mirror. And in fact, it would even behave like a mirror, because when I approach it, it would show my own image. So we put a camera in the middle of the screen. We took, in fact, the same camera that we saw on for the video probe. We broke it. We just took the image sensor, put it in the middle. Then this is the work of the designers. They ran wires to the rest of the electronics that was on the back. So this is just the CCD sensor, camera sensor, and here are the wires that connects it to the rest of the electronics. And the funny thing is, this camera was in the middle of the screen, in effect, or the mirror. And people did not notice it. Time and again, people asked them, where is the camera? The other thing is, the device has a proximity sensor, an ultrasonic sensor that tells the distance of the closest object. These sensors are pretty flaky, so this is the type of things you had in Polaroid cameras to do the automatic focusing and things like this. They're very cheap, but not very reliable. And the same principle as for the video probe, two of these devices are linked together. Now, what we do is we merge the local and the remote image. So if we are each facing our mirror, I see my image and I see the other person's image merged together. The other feature is with the proximity sensor, when the proximity sensor says that the nearest object is far away, we make the image blurry. And as you get closer, the image is sharper. So if I have the device standing there, and I'm, you know, at home and I walk by at this distance, I will get this kind of blurry shape. As I approach it, it signifies that I want to engage with communication, like we do in real life, when we get closer to talk together. The idea of superimposing the two images is that it creates an intimate form of communication. And this is something we saw when we deployed this. Now, the sad part of this is that we were not able to deploy it in the families, because at the time there was just not enough high bandwidth internet access to have live video. We tried it, it just didn't work. It was flaky, it would shut down all the time, it wouldn't give you good quality image, there was a lot of delay. So what we did instead is that we exhibited it in various public exhibits. First in 2002 internal meeting of this disappearing computer project, where all the projects were showing what they were doing. So not very interesting for us, because these are not real users. Then we had three exhibits at Jeune Création, which is a place that was in La Villette, Mandeuve, which is north of Paris, and finally at the Pompidou Center in Beaubourg, in a design exhibit. And so what we would do is we would put these two devices, so there were several generations that you see here. In the first three cases, it was in a room where one device was on one wall and the other was on the other wall. And there was no explanation. At the Pompidou Center, they built this wall and we put one mirror on each side of it. And there was a little bit of text here, but nobody reads the text in the exhibit. So. And then we sat down and we looked what happened. And what happened time and again is people approach the device and they realize they can see themselves. And they also get a sense of this blurry effect. And then while they are looking at themselves in the mirror, someone approaches the other one and they realize they can see each other. And they realize, like in the holding space, oh, there is a communication channel there. And then one of two things happen. If the people know each other, they play with the image being superimposed. If the people don't know each other, they step away. Because it's very weird to see your image mixed with someone you don't know. But if it's, you know, your boyfriend or girlfriend, or your friend, or someone you know, you play with the images, you put your eyes in front of the eyes, etc. And so I have a few videos of this. So this is the concept videos that the designers put together before we built anything. So they used a video editing software to simulate what would happen. So, you know, this blur, how do you adjust it? What distance should be? And so you can play games like if I put my hand in front, it will, the system will think I'm closer. So you can play with that. The other one was about this transparency effect, which at the time was not the kind of thing that was easy to build in software, so we wanted to prototype it with I don't know if you have time to see that, but what I find fascinating is that at the end, when you see the two faces, you can look at one or the other. It's possible to focus your attention on one image without being too much disturbed by the other. Now, the interesting thing is that when these are images of people you know, it's even a lot easier. When it's people you don't know, I guess it's not the same. So anyway, these were the design videos. Then this was the first installation with it. And so we see people here playing with the superimposition of the faces. So this is a camera that people didn't notice.
Mirror Space is a telepresence installation that merges together multiple video streams from remote locations. In the first public showing of the work, two mirrors were connected to each other.
This one is my favorite one. So there's this couple. They come in front of one of these, and you can see the sensor isn't working that well. And they look at each other, and it's funny. Okay, well, we love each other. It's cool. And then this guy said, "But look, there's another one there." And says, "Wait a minute," and he goes over there. And she doesn't realize immediately, but oh, I can see you. Now his image is blurry because the sensor was a bit confused, but here he's back into focus. And then she goes there. Anyway. So we saw that time and again. And not sure what the last one here is. It's very short. Yeah, that's the one we saw in the other video. Yeah, there's two women, and they were really they had the same similar faces, so it was very funny to put them exactly. So, from this project, what we realized is that, again, people don't necessarily need to have high bandwidth communication. They don't necessarily need to talk to each other. We had no audio in the system. If we had audio, it would probably have the same notion that if you're far away, the audio is not recorded, and the audio would be on only if two people are next to each side of the thing, so I could not listen to what's happening in the remote side, but just approaching one side and things like this. But of course, once people were sort of connected, they wanted to engage in more direct communication. And so Nicolas Roussel, who's one of the people working on this project, came up with this notion of multi-scale communication. So in the same way as we were working, in fact, on multi-scale interfaces, like, you know, zooming in and out in Google Maps or in a document, this notion could apply to communication. So, you know, we have social protocols to engage in communication. If I'm our office building and I walk and I see someone at the other end of the corridor, I have 10, 20 seconds to approach that person. And in just 10, 20 seconds, my body language will tell that other person whether I'm willing to interact or not. You know, I may walk faster and look down, or I may slow down and look at the person until she looks at me, or we have all sorts of very subtle code in our body language to decide how we're going to interact. When people communicate, they're also very good at picking up cues. Well, some people are at least, whether I'm boring this person or not, or whether this person is interested, or whether, you know, the person is interested but needs to go. So, and so we engage in all these forms of communication with varying degrees of engagement. The problem is the computer systems do not support the social protocols. And not just computer systems, but systems like the telephone. I think I talked about these cultural differences, but in France in particular, if I call someone on the phone and this person is busy talking to a real person, she's very likely to pick up the phone and interrupt the face-to-face communication to give priority to the remote communication. If you go to the US, it's the exact opposite. If I'm talking to you in my office, and the phone rings, and I pick up the phone, I'm the rudest person. I'm saying, go away, I don't want to talk to you. Now, of course, for the caller, there's no way to know if the person is busy or not. Whereas in real life, when I go by someone's office, in a peek of the eye, I can see if this person is busy or not. So, in our systems, shifting from email to chat or text to phone call to video call requires shifting from one system to the next. And each system knows nothing about the rest of the communication landscape. So the idea of multi-scale communication was to support this transition, to go from peripheral awareness with mirror space. If I'm far away, I'm a blurry shape. But I can see there is a shape, that the person is moving, or is more or less active. With a bit of training, when the system would be set up between two homes, for example, even if it's very blurry, I can recognize people. I can know who is there, but without having all the detail. So we go from this notion of peripheral awareness, of being aware of what the others are doing, to more direct focused communication. In the mirror space example, the idea was just to approach. By approaching the device, I want to engage in this communication. My image becomes sharper, and I tell the other, well, if you want to approach, you can have direct focused communication. But the same thing when the communication ends or transitions to a state that is less engaged. There have been a number of studies in sociology about the notion of proxemics. I don't know if you've heard of proxemics, but it's a study of the distances that people use when they interact. And, you know, one way to describe it very roughly is that we have a private space, which is about a meter. You know, if I approach you less than a meter, I'm intruding, right? If I'm at a meter, yeah, we can have a conversation, we don't have to know each other too well, it's fine. Then if I'm beyond 5 meters, it's sort of the public space and all that. And this is something not just with humans. There have been many studies of, if you look at the way birds sit on the wire, they have very fixed distances. So it's something that is really, you know, built into, mammals in general. So from the studies of proxemics, we can build on that to build systems that take this into account and take advantage of the skills we have to give meaning to distance, to define several levels of communication. That's something that unfortunately we didn't have a chance to continue in that project. But you can see a number of systems that have been developed since then that sort of go in that direction. So, when I was in San Francisco, one of the first places I visited was this place called Willow Garage. Now, Willow Garage is a startup that was created a few years back that does a lot of research in robots. And one of the things they built is these robots that have a camera, a screen, loudspeakers, and a microphone. And they are robots, so you can make them move. And they use that for what they call video surveys. So here this person is talking to that person who's sitting, you know, I don't know, the other side of the country. But this person has control of this robot. So with a joystick, he can turn it around, move forward, backward, and also operate the camera and things like this. They even have some, and I'm sure this is one of them, where it can also adjust the height. So you can like go into a meeting room and sort of sit or stand up and go. And as you can see, they have a number of them in their lab. And it's interesting because they become part of the environment, and they were telling us that, you know, it's actually got to play with one of them. They have a telephone booth where you can go in there and remote control one of these robots, and it takes a bit of learning because, you know, you don't have a very wide field of vision. There's actually two cameras. There's one for that gives this image for some face-to-face conversation, but there's also, I think, one underneath here that gives you wide angle of where you're going. But the thing is, you know, as you approach a door, for example, a door is a problem because pushing the door open, the robot cannot do it. But people spontaneously open the door for you and etc. So, so this is a case where by having this embodiment, and people are telling us that they have regular meetings with remote workers, and to them, they can't really tell if they're there or not there, because some of these people come in the lab sometimes, and sometimes are there remotely, and it's kind of blurry in people's head of whether the person was physically there or not. So you know, we see some elements of trying to go more into this richer type of communication. What we don't see is this transitioning. I mean, I know, you know, some, I don't know, email on the Mac, for example, gives you the status of your buddies, as they call them, for instant messaging and things like this. But this is still very fragmented, and communication by nature is not fragmented. We transition all the time between levels of communication. So to summarize this, video communication is very powerful. As I've said, people instantly recognize when there is a way to communicate through a video channel. Of course, with great power comes great responsibilities, so the privacy issues are really important. I didn't really talk about them, but people are very sensitive to it, and they should be. Most people want to communicate not with the world, like Facebook and others would like you to think, but with their close family and friends, and they want to have private conversations. You know, this business of putting photos of myself for the world to see, this is something that people really don't care about, and those who think it's important, 20 years from now, they will regret it. Third, communication is a process. And by that I mean that there's various phases of engaging into the communication, stopping it or stepping out of it. And from direct focus exchange to peripheral awareness, we constantly shift between these levels of engagement. And unfortunately, the current technology makes the wrong assumptions. Privacy is critical, and most systems don't support proper privacy for purely business reasons, which is really bad. We constantly shift between levels of engagement, but the technology doesn't let us do it. And communication is something we do transparently in the world. We don't have to. I don't have to push buttons or to operate things to say I want to communicate with you. Most of the technology that we have today makes this very difficult. You have to have lists of contacts. I mean, you know, I have an email address, I have a Skype thing, I don't have a Twitter or Facebook account, but I should, apparently. I mean, you have different identities, and so there's no notion of I want to communicate with someone and then adjust the level of communication, because there are many identities for the persons I want to reach. So while technological mediation for communication should be as transparent as possible, in current system it is very intrusive. So these are some references that I've put on the website, or will if they're not there yet. Well, the first one is a weird one because the information is very big book by James Leake. And only part of this is really irrelevant, but it's an excellent book for your general culture if you want to read it. I think it's come out in paperback, so you don't have to buy the big hardcover version. But what I like and what's relevant to this is all the history of ways in which humans have communicated. So it starts from tribes in Africa banging on trees or on drums, to the smoke signals of Indians, but then to all the technology, and there's a whole chapter of something I had no knowledge whatsoever of, which is embarrassing, that in Europe, in the before the telephone was widely deployed, and before the telegraph was deployed, they were created this system of semaphores for visual communication between stations, so you could communicate signals without, electrical signals. These were visual signals, and they created a whole network in Europe for this in late 1800s. So, fascinating book where, even though it's called The Information, a lot of it is about communication because it's about the exchange of information. These are two books that were published. Roughly 10 years interval about media spaces by people who've been there a lot. You don't have to read books, but this, if you are going to read something about media spaces, it should be probably this paper, because this was the first paper that summarizes a lot of the work on media spaces. I have a link on the webpage on the chapter that was written by Wendy more recently that sort of looks at that like 10 years later. And then this is a paper on technology probes that I mentioned that is very highly cited, and that explains this idea of putting technology that is not really a product into the hands of people to see how they use it, and have other links as well for the things I described, Video Probe and Mirror Space in particular. Okay, do you have any questions?
Yeah, about Mirror Space.
Mirror Space.
Mirror Space. I didn't understand why you merged the image, because it would have worked as well without RGB.
Yes, the thing is, if we don't display your own image, you have this device sitting there on the wall, you approach it and nothing happens. You have no feedback. For you to see something, there has to be someone at the other end. And so, we didn't test the two designs, so I can only say, you know, what we thought is that this would not be as engaging. And we call it Mirror Space because it is a mirror, and I'm pretty sure people would use it also as a mirror at home. They approach it, they see themselves. And so it would remind them that it's there. Now, of course, we could have made it so that when both people approach it, since we have this sensor, we could switch off the local image. But then what we discovered through this prototyping phase, and then when we started building it, is that this notion of superimposition is really interesting. People play with it spontaneously.
It's fun.
Well, but it's more than fun. It's more than fun because it gives people this. The way my own experience is that it's a more intimate relationship than a pure, you know, just video chat display. And people spontaneously will, you know, sidestep, so we each are on one side of the screen and we don't sort of merge our images, or play with merging the images. So it doesn't really get in the way of the communication in our experience. But, you know, this, as I said, this came towards the end of the project. We were not able to deploy it in real families, so we didn't, you know, it was, for us, it's not a solution. It's a way to explore the problem. So we stopped before we could really learn everything we could from it, because the project ended and people went away. The two designers, Helen Evans and Heiko Hansen, are still in Paris. She's British, he's German, but they still do projects in Paris. And so, yeah, they had to leave the project, and so we couldn't go to the next step, which is, okay, let's see what people actually do with this and how we could go from this exploratory tool to something more finished and that addresses maybe more needs. But I'm pretty sure we would keep some element of this merging, because I think it makes it a different type of medium.
Yeah, from feedback. It's disturbing to see people immersed on the screen. So, you can use the blur feature a different way to blur out the imaging.
We played with a number of ideas around this. There is follow up work by Nicolas Roussel with Sofiane Guedana, who was his PhD student, where they explored ways to record video. So it was sort of a mix between Mirror Space and Video Probe. In Video Probe, we were taking snapshots. In their subsequent work, I can't remember the name of the system, but they were recording video clips, and then these were being replayed, and they were organized spatially. So, I mean, there's a lot of things to be explored there, but the thing is, we didn't continue on that research. Now, we are going to get back to this because, as we talked, I think, when we were presenting the internships, we have this big project called Digiscope, where we are building these large interactive rooms with large wall displays or virtual reality systems. We're going to hook them up together with video codecs, so video communication. And you know, one solution is to, in addition to the big wall, set the screen on the side where you have the talking heads, so you can talk to each other. But I think this is boring and it's not going to work. So what I'm interested in doing is saying, well, let's get this video signal. How can we merge with the stuff we are interacting with on this large wall or in this immersive room? How can people work together, have this sense of peripheral awareness that we are working together even though we are not in the same room? We also want to build some of these robots and put them in the room so that the remote people are sort of physically present in the room. See what works, what doesn't. And my take is that there's not going to be one solution that works for everything. I am still fascinated by this notion that you can overlay images and your eyes, your brain, are able to focus on one image and without being disturbed so much by the others. And that, you know, with respect to mirror space, is something that is a lot stronger when you are one of the person in there, because you control your movement, and so you have an interactive loop. When you observe it, it's not the same. So I think there's a lot more work to be done in that area, and I don't know. It's both fascinating and depressing to me that there's so little innovation when the technology is there to do high quality live video and things like this today. So I was saying, we played with various ways of merging the images, because we could see which part is moving, so do some, you know, more clever compositing of images. But we stick with the simplest one in that part of the project. Other questions? Nope. Okay, well, I suggest we take a break, and after the break we'll move to shared editing.